Good afternoon, everybody. I'm just going to give a snippet of an introduction before Alex starts to talk about why you're about to see what countries do at a national level on their policy and to motivate why we might care about that. For those who have been in the United States, traveled in the United States, know anything about their policy, they know that the policy south of the border is quite different than much of the world. So one of the issues we faced was we were trying to get any kind of paid sick leave passed, 7 days. In a Canadian context, people say 7 days? You spend how many years working on this really small issue? But it turns out to affect the poor, lose a lot of jobs, affects the middle class, but there are real inequalities. To cut a long story short, the U.S. Senate and Congress said, we can't afford it. Nobody does it. Our competitors can't. So we started to map what the world policy was. And when you map it, what you find is that 160 countries have paid sick leave. All of the most competitive do. All of the OECD countries with low unemployment do. And it starts to change the debate. This mapping of what other countries do empowers people at a local level as well as at a national level. Switch to halfway around the world. We used to go around from this world initiative that we have looking at policies, and I would say the only countries without paid maternity leave are Lesotho, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, Swaziland, and the United States of America. Now, I have to tell you, as an American by birth, I was trying to push the United States to do something about that, but it was labor folks in Lesotho who first wrote me and said, great, that's fantastic, that was very helpful, but stop naming us already with the United States. We did pass it now. So these can have impact. So fast forward to the environment. We're at the beginning of an initiative of starting to collect what environmental policy is, both on the prevention side and in terms of the adaptation side. Why both, briefly? In 48 of 80 low- and middle-income countries, I want to give you an education example, at least 30% of adults have less than 4 years of school. Same time, 72 million primary school children are out of school. Now, in the case of something like education, where we know we've missed it for adults and we're missing it for kids, we don't say we can do one or the other. We don't say just prevent future illiteracy or address current. We say do both. The view we take is that on the environment, on climate change, which you just heard a fantastic presentation from James about the impact on indigenous communities, we know that there are profound inequalities across social class on who's really already affected by climate change, that we absolutely need to do both. We need to do something to minimize the impact of the changes that have already occurred, and we need to work together and work on policies to mitigate future impact. So you're going to hear now from Alex about the first part of that initiative where we look at Annex 1 countries. Why? Because that's where we could get some data on a shoestring to begin this process of looking, is something being done?
Jody. Good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm just going to share some insights with you on climate change adaptation from a project that I've been working on for about the last year that's based both in the Department of Geography and here at the IHSP. I'm going to start us off with just an overview of the research objectives of this project and an introduction to the methodology that we developed in order to conduct a systematic assessment of adaptation in the developed world. We began this project about a year ago with the overall question, how far have developed countries progressed on adapting to health impacts of climate change? Now, the essential goal of asking this was to assess the status of adaptation both directly within the health sector and within certain health-relevant sectors, for instance, emergency management, water, or agriculture. Now, to answer this question, we selected 38 of the 41 Annex 1 parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, who represent both advanced and transitioning economies. And then we measured their adaptation responses based on self-reporting that's conducted through national communications submitted periodically to the UNFCCC Secretariat. Now, just to give you an idea of the sort of countries that we were looking at, these Annex I parties represent 29 of the 34 OECD countries and have a combined population of about 1.7 billion people, or in other words, about 25% of the global population. These countries share certain characteristics. They're all industrialized. They have fairly low prevalences of poverty, and they all have fairly high institutional capacities. Next, we identified crucial health risks from climate change that have really emerged in the academic literature and are really demanding the attention of health policymakers around the world. These risks include things like extreme temperatures, both extreme cold and extreme heat, air quality, extreme weather events, for instance, flooding, storms, droughts, fires, or land shifts, water safety and security, and food safety and security, which basically just means water and food quality and quantity, and infectious diseases, both rodent-borne and vector-borne. Now, we assessed progress on adaptation reached by these 38 countries on three levels. The lowest and most basic level is just demonstrated understanding, recognition that these vulnerabilities are going to pose a particular threat to these countries in the future as our climate continues to change. These are just basic statements that indicate an awareness of the growing nature of these risks within each of these national contexts. The next level we termed groundwork actions. These are steps that are taken to inform and prepare for adaptation, but do not actually constitute tangible changes in policies or in the delivery of government services. So these groundwork actions consist of things like vulnerability assessments or adaptation research, conceptual tools, for instance, action plans or strategies, stakeholder networking sessions, such as we're engaged in right now, or policy recommendations. The highest level of action is actual adaptation, which we defined as changes that are made to built environments, to government services, organizational mandates, or regulations taken in direct response to climate change risks. Now, this study was not intended to be a complete inventory of adaptation actions taken in the developed world, but rather it presents a broader picture of current trends in health adaptation happening within these Annex I countries. And our results were really very telling about the current status of adaptation among Annex I countries. First, it became evident that major health vulnerabilities are not being addressed by all of these countries. Only 13 countries, for example, have adaptation responses taken in response to extreme heat, which is really one of the most widely discussed and visible risks associated with climate change. Countries like Portugal or New Zealand, who are already feeling these impacts, are really failing to demonstrate that policymakers even recognize the significance of a relationship between a changing climate and extreme heat. Furthermore, while we know that hotter and drier conditions are going to exacerbate the threat of forest fires, only a handful of countries have taken adaptation measures to increase their resilience to this particular risk. Note especially Russia, which last summer experienced the longest heat wave in its history since 1981 and experienced forest fires that resulted in about $15 billion worth of damage, and yet has not moved beyond the most preliminary steps to address this risk area. On a more positive note, however, floods emerged as a health vulnerability of greatest concern among all Annex I countries, with every country being able to at least recognize the growing risk of flooding within their country. 17 nations were able to identify at least one adaptation action that's been taken in response to these risks. And similarly, water safety and security emerged as another big concern among these countries. Again, 17 countries identified adaptations in the water sector, although some countries like Australia, where water shortages are already a growing concern, have yet to demonstrate that appropriate adaptation responses are being undertaken. Overall, however, water really emerged as the most robust response area, along with flooding. Now, beyond just assessing the status of adaptation actions, we were also interested in assessing how widely these responses are reaching all segments of the population, especially those groups considered to be most vulnerable to the health impacts of climate change. We identified 12 groups who are typically considered to be most vulnerable to poor health outcomes, for example, people living in poverty, racial and ethnic minorities, women, children, the elderly. And we examined whether discussions about adaptation and vulnerability are taking these groups into consideration. What became really clear is that the integration of vulnerable groups into adaptation planning and implementation is really underdeveloped and uneven across Annex I countries. So the elderly, for instance, who are widely considered to be one of the most vulnerable groups to extreme temperatures and extreme weather events, you can take an example like the 2003 European heat waves, for instance, where of 15,000 fatalities in France alone, the majority of these individuals were 75 years old or older. What we see, however, is that half of Annex I countries are failing to discuss the elderly at all in their national reports. Most countries that do discuss climate change vulnerability among older individuals are only focusing on particular vulnerabilities, most notably heat and sometimes air quality. Again, here we see that countries are failing to demonstrate that special consideration is being taken of individuals with chronic or pre-existing conditions, in spite of the fact that, for example, individuals with respiratory conditions are much more likely to suffer in extreme heat conditions and as a result of declining air quality. Now, this is particularly problematic for countries like Spain, Portugal, or Italy, where rising temperatures are going to be felt really strongly. As you can see here, however, none of these countries have demonstrated any consideration of these vulnerable groups. This map I find particularly striking. Virtually no country is demonstrating awareness of the impact of a changing climate on individuals with disabilities, much less discussing how their needs are being integrated into adaptation planning or implementation. Only two countries, Belarus and Greece, are considering disabled persons at all in their reporting, and their discussions are really limited to only a handful of vulnerabilities. Now, just to give you an idea of how problematic this is, imagine implementing an emergency response protocol following a 100-year storm like Hurricane Katrina that doesn't consider how to evacuate individuals with mobility impairments. As you can imagine, it's not going to be very effective. Now, regarding indigenous groups, the news is both positive and negative. On the one hand, Canada has really emerged as a leader here in demonstrating an awareness of the diverse ways in which indigenous groups are going to be affected by a changing climate. Canada discusses indigenous groups in relation to 10 health vulnerabilities, which is fairly significant. The U.S., Australia, New Zealand, all of whom also have fairly large indigenous populations, also indicate an awareness of the relationship between a handful of these vulnerabilities and indigenous groups. On the other hand, however, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Russia, and Denmark fail to discuss indigenous groups at any point in their reporting, in spite of the fact that they all have fairly significant indigenous populations. No vulnerable group that we looked at was considered in relation to all health vulnerabilities that we identified, and it really became very clear that countries were more aware of vulnerable groups in relation to particular risk areas like heat or air quality, and were failing to demonstrate an understanding of how other risk areas are going to affect these groups. Now, based on this kind of data, we can conclude that progress on adaptation is really piecemeal and still underdeveloped. Awareness of the significance of climate change impacts on health is growing, but policymakers really need to engage more deeply with stakeholders in order to design and implement adaptation strategies that take into consideration a range of impacts that we're already beginning to feel today, and with a special consideration for those groups who are considered most vulnerable to poor health outcomes. Policymakers also need to engage in broader intersectoral cooperation on adaptation issues, since it really presents an opportunity to enhance our understanding of how climate change is going to affect the health of our communities. Finally, evaluations of adaptation initiatives that are already in place are going to be crucial if we're to improve existing strategies and assess the relative advantages of various approaches. These findings suggest that countries have not yet started to conduct rigorous evaluations of adaptation programs, which may be limiting the effectiveness of these strategies now and into the future. So on that note, I'm going to turn things back to Jody, who's going to give us some thoughts on where we go from here.
Thank you, Alex. What we hope to do with this tool, and I hope you could see it by the maps that Alex showed, is just make what every country is doing transparent, readily accessible to individuals and groups on the ground who want to do something about it. Before this, what you would need to do is go through hundreds for individual countries, thousands across all the countries of pages of text that are in different languages to try to figure out what's going on, something that's obviously an untenable barrier. The goal of this is to have a simple tool anybody can access on their handheld device, on a computer, where we can get it out to many groups to work on. As we move it forward, we'll very much want to do this on both different aspects of the environment, but also, again, on the prevention side as well as on the adaptation side. I opened with an analogy about education and labor. I want to close with one about AIDS. I was at a meeting 2 decades ago when we first started to talk about getting enough dollars for treatment. That was, in a sense, like actually getting the adaptation in place. It was really about the inequalities and who had access to treatment. That virus was already out. Climate change is already happening. We need to make sure it doesn't have devastating effects on the most vulnerable communities. The great story about AIDS is that treatment rates did rise. The access rose by the millions. And The cautionary tale about AIDS is the extent to which, in many countries, the new cases kept rising at the same rate as people were getting on treatment. So clearly, when it comes to climate change, like the other major challenges, we're going to have to continue to ensure that we have that equal sense of urgency about preventing more from happening, as well as addressing what's already happened. Thanks very much.